Blog Talk Radio.
I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we are going to be talking about the book, The Might of the Thoughts, Mach der Gedanken by Billy Meyer. Specifically, I'm going to pick back up on about page 280, where we'll be talking about unsatisfaction. The truth of the existence of unsatisfaction, namely, lies entirely elsewhere, and indeed in the human being himself or herself, who produces it through unfulfillable ideas and unreal ideas, which he / she can never bring to full expression, and can also never develop into ideas capable of realization. Now, unsatisfaction is the state or attitude of not being satisfied, to be discontent, to have displeasure. Unsatisfaction is a particular cause of the feeling of displeasure or disappointment. Notice that we produce unsatisfaction through unfulfillable and unreal ideas. Unreal means so strange that it appears imaginary, not seemingly real. If something is unfulfillable, it cannot be brought into completion or reality. So we must make sure that our ideas are realizable, or we can fall into unsatisfaction. We must have goals that we can fulfill. Unsatisfaction is therefore devastating and destructive, and therefore in no wise such that a certain amount of it is absolutely necessary in order to reach a certain zeal, as claimed by the erring religionists and hack writers of positive thinking texts. So what is Billy saying here? First of all, let's define this word zeal. For Billy, zeal means culmination point or end. The English terms aim or goal are not acceptable, he says, for defining this term. It's a culmination point, so it's the point where you put a whole lot of things together to reach some state. So that's why they just bring the German word zeal over into the English, because they can't really translate it. So when we have unsatisfaction, it undermines our goals, undermines any kind of ultimate culmination point that we want to have. And when something is devastating, it means that it's highly destructive. So unsatisfaction is very destructive. So if you are in a state of unsatisfaction, then it might be an indication that your thoughts have slipped out of the desired neutral balance. Let me pick up again here, Might of Thoughts, page 280. Unsatisfaction is unable to create any ideas or any balance of the personality. Consequently, neither progress nor success can arrive from unsatisfaction. Notice that unsatisfaction is unable to create ideas or balance in the personality. In philosophy, ideas are usually construed as mental representations. The capacity to create and understand the meaning of ideas is considered to be one of the essential things that humanity does. So unsatisfaction cannot help with the creation of concepts. Again, a concept is an abstract idea, a general notion, a plan or intention. Now, one of the people that talked about ideas was a man named Plato. And he was one of the earliest philosophers to provide a detailed discussion of ideas. Now, it's important to note that Plato had a different notion of an idea than we do. Plato had something called the theory of forms or the theory of ideas, which asserted that there were non-material abstract forms or ideas that had the highest and most fundamental kind of reality. And the material world, known to us through sensation, is different than this higher form of reality. The higher form of reality was in the ideas, according to Plato. Now, from Plato's perspective, ideas represent the highest and most fundamental reality. Therefore, since unsatisfaction in our thoughts shuts down ideas, perhaps unsatisfaction shuts down our highest connection to the highest forms of reality. Well, here, I have a clip on Plato here, and it'll just take me a second to cue it up. It's a little bit off the topic of the might of thoughts, but not really. So let's listen to what Plato had to say. Just a second here, this clip's getting started.
Athens, 2,400 years ago. It's a compact place. Only about a quarter of a million people live here. There are fine baths, theatres, temples, shopping arcades, and gymnasiums. It's warm for more than half the year. This is also home to the world's first true and probably greatest philosopher, Plato. Born into a prominent and wealthy family in the city, Plato devoted his life to one goal, helping people to reach a state of what he termed eudaimonia, or fulfillment. Plato is often confused with Socrates. Socrates was an older friend who taught Plato a lot but didn't write any books. Plato wrote lots of them, 36, all dialogues, beautifully crafted scripts of imaginary discussions in which Socrates is always allotted a starring role, among them the Republic, the Symposium, the Laws, the Meno, and the Apology. Plato had four big ideas for making life more fulfilled. First big idea, think more. We rarely give ourselves time to think carefully and logically about our lives and how to lead them. Sometimes we just go along with what the Greeks called doxa, or popular opinions. In the 36 books he wrote, Plato showed this common sense to be riddled with errors, prejudice, and superstition. Fame is great. Follow your heart. Money is the key to a good life. The problem is, popular opinions edge us towards the wrong values, careers, and relationships. Plato's answer is, know yourself.
Okay, I'll pick up here in a second. Plato says, know yourself. Isn't it very similar to what Edward Albert Meyer is talking about here with self-cognition? Plato talked about the importance of thinking, and also Edward Albert Meyer is telling us about the importance of our thoughts. Page 280, it says that unsatisfaction kills off all initiative for striving towards that which is higher, and lets human beings sink into a brooding misery and into inactivity. Additionally, the human being always feels oversaturated on account of his or her thoughts, which overburden him in this regard, and the resulting feelings of the same kind, as a result which the psyche is also affected in the same way. So unsatisfaction destroys our motivation. It destroys our initiative. Initiative is the power or opportunity to act or to take charge. Initiative also means readiness and ability in taking action. So when we cave in to unsatisfaction, that stops our readiness. It stops our initiative. It stops our motivation. Unsatisfaction can lead to a kind of brooding, which is the showing of deep unhappiness. So unsatisfaction can lead to unhappiness. Again, it all comes down to our thoughts. Now, when we get into this state of unsatisfaction, our consciousness gets saturated. And we stop having the ability to master our lives. And what happens is, with this unsatisfaction and the oversaturation of our consciousness, we have an absence of creativity. Absolutely no ideas can be created and are developed when our consciousness is oversaturated with wrong thinking. Intentions, wishes, imagination, all that shuts down. So let's summarize this real quick. Wrong thinking leads to oversaturation. Oversaturation leads to the absence of creativity. The absence of creativity leads to the lack of ideas. And then the lack of ideas leads to a lack of initiative. So essentially, unsatisfaction kills motivation. It kills striving. We start to feel oversaturated. Oversaturation means to soak, to impregnate, to thoroughly imbue something. It means to cause a substance to unite with the greatest possible amount of another substance. This happens through chemical combinations and the like. I think when unsatisfaction sets in, we become oversaturated with our own negative thinking. Much like we become oversaturated with the endless repetitions of the same episodes of a sitcom on TV or commercials, we become oversaturated with a certain song that's overplayed on the radio, and we can become oversaturated with our own negative thinking, which leads to this absence of creativity. Unsatisfaction is inevitably connected with a profound absence of creativity, which in turn is anchored in the absence of initiative. So one of the things that this book talks about here is making sure we don't fall into being unsatisfied. So we need to keep ourselves from these destructive thoughts, which can take many forms and pollute our consciousness. Let me pick back up in our little clip here with what Plato told us.
He's doing a special kind of therapy, philosophy, subjecting your ideas to examination rather than acting on impulse. If you strengthen your self-knowledge, you don't get so pulled around by feelings. Plato compared the role of our feelings to being dragged dangerously along by a group of wild horses. In honor of his mentor and friend Socrates, this kind of examination is called a Socratic discussion. You can have it with yourself, or ideally with another person who isn't trying to catch you out, but wants to help you clarify your own ideas. Second big idea, let your lover change you. That sounds weird if you think that love means finding someone who wants you just the way you are. In a symposium, Plato's play about a dinner party where a group of friends drink too much and get talking about love, sex, and relationships, Plato says, true love is admiration. In other words, the person you need to get together with should have very good qualities, which you yourself lack. Let's say they should be really brave or organized or warm and sincere. By getting close to this person, you can become a little like they are. The right person for us helps us grow to our full potential.
So, Plato had a lot of very interesting ideas thousands of years ago. He was way ahead of his time. And you notice he was talking about clarifying thoughts. And the same thing is what Billy has said, that a human being must take effort and take the time to clarify his thought so they can become more valuable, more productive, and more purposive. To clarify means to make a statement or a situation less confused, more clearly comprehensible. And the word confusion means to pour things together. So if you had a glass of tea and a glass of water, and you pour these two things together, what you have there is a confusion, a lack of boundary, a lack of distinction. So what we need to do is we need to clarify our thoughts. And just like when a human being starts a garden, you know some kind of plant's going to come up there. Even if you neglect your garden, something's going to come up in that garden, even if it's just weeds. And our consciousness is just like a garden. And if you don't correctly maintain it, you're going to have wildly growing negative thoughts, which lead to confusion and exhaustion. Because these thoughts, once they're animated and created, they develop a life of their own, just like plants. And the reason that people become disturbed is because they tend to have wildly repeating thoughts, because their perceptive abilities become narrowed into a very narrow framework, and we start to repeat the same thoughts and themes over and over again. And we need to learn to broaden our perspective, to nurture good thoughts. Because if you get pulled down by bad thoughts into insanity, into delusion, into a psychical disorder, or just into a bad state of mind, your circumstances will follow your thoughts. And when a human being starts to get shaken, knocked about by circumstances, he's unknowingly, unconsciously created those circumstances, most likely by themselves. And we can be the Lord and Master of our life if we practice self-cognition. What did Plato say? Know yourself. So take up self-examination. Learn to have self-control. Self-cognition would be knowing oneself. So whatever you think will become real. Your good and positive thoughts need to be nurtured. And the human being should have a good and positive opinion of himself or herself. Now, nurture means to feed and protect. Nurture can also mean to support and encourage, like during a period of training, a period of development. The old French, nurture dealt with food, nourishment, education, training. One of the words, the synonyms that will come up for nurture is cherish, if you're looking in a German dictionary. So we should be cherishing healthy and good thoughts. If someone has become a criminal, depraved, if they've fallen into hate, they've had those corresponding thoughts in their consciousness for a long time. And those thoughts can form a prison, particularly addictions, an everlasting circle which seems to have no end. Now, there's all kinds of addictions out there. Addictions can be watching too much TV, eating too much food. And what we have are these reward pathways in our brain that are part of the mesolimbic dopamine system. And we get these reward stimuli from our own brain. It can come from food, from sex, social interaction. And we become addicted to various things. And when you're addicted, your behavior starts to become unconscious. And the rule is that many human beings think unconsciously. I didn't even know that until I started studying this book. We have unconscious thoughts, unconscious feelings. And unconsciously, we can cause the circumstances in our life. The unconscious is the part of the mind that is inaccessible to the conscious mind. It affects our behaviors and emotions. Unconscious processes occur automatically. So our unconscious has the ability to actually cause circumstances in your life. And empirical evidence suggests that our unconscious has repressed feelings, thoughts, habits, automatic reactions, complexes, hidden phobias, and desires. So if you want good and positive things in your life, You have to start to steer your thoughts consciously. If you're maintaining hopes and wishes that are not good, really good, you can create problems for yourselves. There are some yearnings which are not healthy. And our own thoughts can be controlled and maintained along the right path, and this will create an inner freedom and an inner harmony. And some of the synonyms for harmony include concord, unity, peace, friendship. So if we have an inner harmony, it's a good possibility that it came from neutral, positive thinking. Something which is neutral is said to be not supporting either side of a conflict. And Billy talks about neutral as being a balance between the negative and the positive. And the universal consciousness is balanced between the negative and the positive, with a slight emphasis on the positive. And the universal consciousness wants to come into harmonious concord with all people, with all animals, with all plants. And the universal consciousness radiates love. And the incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of the love of creation. And every tiny plant and every tiny animal fulfills its purpose in creation. And love is the highest principle in creation. But this kind of love is not a romantic love, not a love that is subject to changes in mood, but it's a consistent, it's a stable love. It's understanding that we coexist with all plants, all animals, with all people. Now, the German word empfinden is the ability to perceive this fine, sensitive, radiating love of creation. And this would be, can be a great source of refreshment for you if you learn to take the time and to go find a place where you can experience the natural affinity that we have with plants and animals in the natural world. But this takes a little bit of self-control and self-scrutiny. And we need our thoughts to be kept safe and under control, regardless of what outside influences we have in our life. Because the minutest negative vibration of thought and emotion can radiate and become noticeable to others. Our thoughts are incredibly contagious. So are our behaviors. And we need to keep a totally neutral, unbiased attitude towards all forms of life. And we have to be a little bit arduous or laborious in controlling our thoughts and making sure that they're neutral, positive. Now, in the third millennium, it's a time when confusion is spreading throughout the world and maliciousness. And that's because people's thoughts are a bit out of control. People are in a state of asartang or gewalt, and their emotions are surging up like lightning, uncontrollable. Now, thoughts manifest slowly. Feelings manifest slowly and are always preceded by thoughts, which is a big contrast to emotions, which are not preceded by a thought process, which are not preceded by any thoughts, typically emotions are. So anyway, let's take a short break here and pick up again with the philosophy of Plato, which I believe has a whole lot of practical application in our lives.
For Plato, in a good relationship, a couple shouldn't love each other exactly as they are right now. They should be committed to educating each other and to enduring the stormy passages this inevitably involves. each person should want to seduce the other into becoming a better version of themselves. 3. Decode the message of beauty. Everyone pretty much likes beautiful things, but Plato was the first to ask, why do we like them? He found a fascinating reason. Beautiful objects are whispering important truths to us about the good life. We find things beautiful when we unconsciously sense in them qualities we need but are missing in our lives. Gentleness, harmony, balance, peace, strength. Beautiful objects, therefore, have a really important function. They help to educate our souls. Ugliness is a serious matter too. It parades dangerous and damaged characteristics in front of us. It makes it harder to be wise, kind, and calm. Plato sees art as therapeutic. It's the duty of poets and painters, and nowadays novelists, TV producers, and designers, to help us to live good lives. 4. Reform society. Plato spent a lot of time thinking how the government and society should ideally be. He was the world's first utopian thinker. In this, he was inspired by Athens's great rival, Sparta. This was a city-sized machine for turning out great soldiers. Everything the Spartans did, how they raised their children, how their economy was organized, whom they admired, how they had sex, what they ate, was tailored to that one goal. And Sparta was hugely successful from a military point of view. But that wasn't Plato's concern. He wanted to know, how could a society get better at producing not military power, but fulfilled people? In his book, The Republic, Plato identifies a number of changes that should be made. Athenian society was very focused on the rich, like the louche aristocrat Alcibiades, and sports celebrities like the boxer Milo of Croton. Plato wasn't impressed. It really matters who we admire, because celebrities influence our outlook, ideas, and conduct, and bad heroes give glamour to flaws of character. Plato therefore wanted to give Athens new celebrities, replacing the current crop with ideally wise and good people he called guardians, models for everyone's good development. These people would be distinguished by their record of public service, their modesty and simple habits, their dislike of the limelight, and their wide and deep experience. They would be the most honored and admired people in society. He also wanted to end democracy in Athens. He wasn't crazy. He just observed how few people think properly before they vote, and therefore we get very substandard rulers. He didn't want to replace democracy with a horrid dictatorship, but he wanted to prevent people from voting until they'd started to think rationally. That is, until they'd become philosophers. Otherwise, government would just be a kind of mob rule. To help the process, Plato started a school, the Academy, in Athens, which lasted a good 300 years. There, pupils learned not just maths and spelling, but also how to be good and kind. His ultimate goal was that politicians should become philosophers. The world will not be right, he said, until kings become philosophers or philosophers kings.
Well, those are some fantastic ideas from Plato, how they're so true today. We have the same issue here. We have bad heroes. And he was talking about bad heroes in the ancient past who gave glamour to flaws in character. Now, how's that for telling us the importance of studying history so we can keep from repeating the errors of the past? Well, I have another clip here that I'd like to start in a second here that talks about some of the other great thinkers of the past like Socrates and Plato. And let's just go ahead and I'll start this clip and then we'll listen here for a bit.
Funding for this program is provided by Annenberg CPB to advance excellent teaching.
The Greek search for wisdom spared them neither from war nor from decline. But the philosophies they left us, their questioning of everything, even the gods themselves, made certain they would never be forgotten. Greek thought, this time on the Western tradition.
UCLA Professor Eugen Weber's continuing journey through the history of Western civilization.
Now, last time, if you recall, we ended with the concept of Sophia, or wisdom, which was so important to the ancient Greeks. They had come to believe that the wisest man was the best man, and that his wisdom could be taught even to the poorest, even to the humblest among them. These days, of course, it's sometimes hard to understand why the Greeks made such a lot of fuss about things of this nature. In fact, our modern view of philosophy in general is that it is abstract and divorced from the real world. But the Greeks had to conquer their wisdom bit by bit, and they found it fascinating as they ascertained it, precisely because it helped them make better sense of the world they lived in. So they did the hard work for us. And their thoughts about nature and reality and God have so profoundly influenced us that we now take them for granted. But in ancient Greece, it was all very new.
As the 5th century before Christ ended, a group of philosophers called the Sophists appeared. The word sophiste means either one who makes wise or possibly one who deals in wisdom. And so these itinerant teachers and lecturers crisscrossed the country, making their living by trading in Sophia. Some of them were good teachers, some of them were not, and a lot of their wisdom came down to teaching quickness of wit in argument so their students could win a case in court or make points in a political debate. Many sophists were regarded as too clever by half and critical and subversive because they were prepared to follow an argument wherever it might lead them. When you go all out after truth, you cannot tell in advance that the truth will be what society would like it to be. The sophist Trasimachus, for instance, argued that rulers and governments make laws to their own advantage and that there's no justice except in the interests of the stronger. Another sophist, Callicles, argued that institutions and moral precepts were established not by gods, but by men like these as a matter of convenience. At least this is what Plato says, Callicles and other sophists thought. Plato was an Athenian born around 427 BC. Among other things, he founded a school of philosophy called the Academy, which evolved into the first real university. This is a Roman mosaic of one of his classes. But Plato is best known for writing a number of dialogues in which philosophical questions were discussed. Because he was a conservative spirit, Plato sometimes made the sophists out to be more subversive than they were, was particularly disturbed by their argument that man is the measure of all things and that man has no way of knowing whether the gods really exist. But conservative as Plato was, he too was going to subvert old ideas simply by teaching that men had to use their own brains and come to conclusions based on observation and reasoning. This, after all, was what his teacher Socrates had taught him. Socrates, whom Plato loved, was probably the most notorious of the sophists, even though he himself didn't want to be considered one and never accepted pay for his teaching, as the sophists did. Socrates' favorite pastime was to argue with fellow Athenians and sting them out of their conventions and accepted ideas. Socrates questioned everything ordinary people took for granted or preferred to leave unquestioned.
Here's some ideas from the ancient past that I think are still useful today. And in some ways are analogous to what we're discussing here, which are the might of our own thoughts. Again, thoughts lead to feelings. Feelings lead to habits. Habits lead to circumstances. Now, our thoughts can be conscious or unconscious. And these lower thoughts, if they run wild, can lead to sorrow, grief, bitterness, errors in judgment. If you are falling into confusion or exhaustion, that can be a sign that you've been circulating negative thoughts. Anxiety is one of the negative thoughts we need to watch out for. Anxiety and fear continually kill thousands of human beings. Anxious thoughts, they have a demoralizing effect in every regard. To be healthy and happy, we need to have neutral, positive thoughts. And our thoughts should not be habitual. We need to steer our thoughts. We need to control our thoughts. If we can control our thoughts while we're alive, then even when we pass over into the realm of death, it will be a magnificent sunset. You shouldn't let your thoughts drift uncontrolled on the ocean of consciousness or unconsciousness. We shouldn't be allowing ourselves to have unhealthy, negative thoughts. We should have constructive, beautiful, positive, happy, equalized thoughts. They'll lead to very productive habits. You'll notice your habits will start to become productive. You'll have motivation. You'll have initiative. Your life will become more organized. You'll have opportunities to help others. There's an erroneous saying which says, live and let live. The word should be, live and help live. And one way you can help life on this planet is through the peace meditation. The fact is that when we have thinking that's in line with creational natural laws, these creational natural laws will give their help to those who are magnanimous. And when you're magnanimous, it means that you're not petty, you don't hold grudges, you help those that are weaker than you, you help rivals, you should be generous in forgiving an insult, free from resentment and vindictiveness. And if you are those things, then these creational natural laws actually help you. And this is mentioned in the book of OM, Omphal and Murado, The Navel of Life. It says, his entire sense is magnanimous, and beauty expresses itself in his plain life, full of spiritual dignity. His inner stillness brings a beauty that no artist can paint and no poet can describe in words. And you notice the inner stillness is that optimism, that inner confidence. That optimism is enchanting to people because it's something people, they want to learn more about. Now, Billy has been able to get information from something called these we forms, which I still need to study more. And these we forms are beyond space and time. So are their perspectives. One of the we forms is called the Patali level. That's the seventh stage of human development. So I don't know, perhaps we go into this kind of group consciousness at that point. I don't know. But that's the final stage before we merge with creation. Remember, there are seven evolutionary steps in our lives. Now, optimism fulfills an extraordinarily important function. We have an innermost nature. Let me define the innermost nature, if I can find it here quickly. We defined zeal earlier. But if you look in the beginning of your book, Might of Thoughts, you'll find a glossary. that defines certain words like Sartung, Empfinden, Gewalt, Weisen, Weisenheit, Zeal. But I think it's in the preface. Hopefully, well, you know how it is when you're looking for something, you'll never find it. But there is Guido Musburger's, I believe it's Guido Musburger's wife, who wrote the preface, which says that we are a humanity that's ill in our consciousness. But she also talked about the inner nature, and that our inner nature comes from the spirit form. Here it is. The impulses for striving higher therefore come out of the innermost nature, which is a component of the spirit form, and therefore purely creational. So you'll see this term innermost nature coming up again and again and repeated in the teaching of the mind of the thoughts. Now, one important thing to hold on to is your optimism. Optimism is a hopefulness. It's a confidence about the future. It's the confidence that there'll be a successful outcome in something. So if you have a project you're working on now, an issue you're working on, you need to have confidence about the future successful outcome of that. Synonyms include hopefulness, cheerfulness. Optimism is kind of a worldview, a mental attitude. Optimism seems to have effect on our health. It's said that optimism helps our psychological well-being. Put simply, optimists emerge through difficult circumstances with less stress than do pessimists. Optimists seems to face problems head-on, taking more active, constructive steps. Remember, if you feel like you're losing initiative, that can be because of unsatisfaction has creeped into your life. It's you're cycling negative thoughts. You may not be completely aware of it. Optimistic behavior enables a human being to see and acknowledge the clear truth, even in a bad situation. Now, an optimist shouldn't be a clown or a comical figure. He's a person who, under the greatest pressure, remains hopeful and happy, and in defiance of all the pressures, of all the breakdowns, of the deplorable state of affairs, he still focuses on that thought of the successful outcome. Optimists may respond better to stress. Remember, if you go into pessimism, if you go into stress, you're releasing something called cortisol, which increases your blood sugar. It suppresses your immune system. It helps in fat metabolism and protein carbohydrate, but it's also immunosuppressive. So stress, if stress is maintained, then you have health problems. And again, optimism is that quality which fascinates all human beings and which every single human being would certainly like to have. So optimism, it comes from the Latin optimum, that which is best. So we should be confident in bad situations, content viewing things from the better side. So let's pick up here with the thinking of the ancient Greeks in our clip here.
Above all, he questioned some of the gods that his countrymen believed in. Greek art is filled with images of gods who kidnap and lie and steal and cheat and murder unjustly and who commit adultery. If these things were bad in a man, how could they be good in a god?
And so Socrates said, better listen to your conscience. Listen to the inner voice that tells you what is truly right. And if you don't know, keep asking questions of yourself and others until you find out. Now, this kind of free thinking approach was particularly disturbing to Athenians at the time because of what was happening to their city. Athens was at war, and the war was going badly.
By the middle of the 5th century BC, Athens had become an empire with its member states circling the Aegean Sea, and this expansion led her into a series of wars, culminating in the Great Peloponnesian War, the war between Athens and the states of the Peloponnesus to the south of it. In 431 BC, Athens was attacked by Sparta, her neighbor, and achieved a standoff. But instead of stopping there, she pursued an aggressive war of expansion in Sicily that led to a catastrophic defeat in 413 BC, in which she lost some 200 ships, 4,500 of her own men, and 10 times as many of her subjects and allies. And yet the fighting continued for another decade. Here's how the historian Thucydides, who actually fought in the war, described it. The Peloponnesian War was a protracted struggle and attended by calamities such as Hellas had never known within a like period of time. Never were so many cities captured and depopulated, some by barbarians, others by Hellenes themselves fighting against one another, and several of them after their capture were repeopled by strangers. Never were exile and slaughter more frequent, whether in the war or brought about by civil strife. This endless and bloody war triggered rebellions throughout the Athenian Empire until Athens was finally defeated in 404 BC. In that year, Athens was forced to surrender unconditionally to Sparta, and its city walls were demolished as a symbol of total defeat. Yet here, in the midst of utter disaster, the Athenians were being told by this poisonous old man Socrates to question everything at a time when most people wanted only to lick their wounds, not pour salt in them. And so after being barely tolerated for decades as an eccentric nuisance, Socrates was put on trial in 399 BC on specific charges of impiety and for corrupting the young, but actually for asking too many unpleasant questions in a time of crisis. This is an 18th century version of how it all ended. Convicted by a very close vote because he wanted to be, Socrates was offered exile but preferred a sentence of death by poison as a martyr to free inquiry.
300 years after Socrates' death, Cicero, the Roman philosopher and statesman, Cicero said that Socrates had brought philosophy down from the heavens. But by wresting it away from the gods and bringing it down to earth, Socrates also helped precipitate a crisis in Greek religion. You might broadly define the crisis as a questioning of civic religion. Each polis had its civic gods and its civic laws, and worshipping the ones and obeying the others was part of being a citizen, part of being a member of the political community. But neither the gods nor the laws had much to say about morality, about real justice, let alone about the soul or what happened to the soul after death. And those were precisely the issue.
So here we are with Athens falling into war and destruction, not listening to their great thinkers. Oh boy. Is it so much different than what we're facing now? So optimism is important. We need to have and continue to have optimism. And we need to be content and view everything from the best side. That doesn't mean we need to be heavily influenced by belief, because belief is very hypnotic, and belief will shut down and make us illogical. It can make us fanatics. It can put us into bondage. Now, belief is confidence in the existence of something that we cannot rigorously prove. Belief has, again, this hypnotic effect. Hypnosis is the induction of a state of consciousness in which a person loses the power of voluntary action and is highly responsive to suggestion. And I have to think about how religions have influenced us so heavily on this planet, and how we have been subject to religion through the years, and how that has... It's also led to a kind of corruption, great corruption here on the earth, because we're no longer thinking logically. Remember that religion tends to shut down our logical thoughts, and when our logic, if we can no longer follow if A then B, if we cannot use deductive reasoning, our consciousness tends to float. And we'll look to be hypnotized. We'll look for the crazy TV preacher, to find the crazy TV preacher to put us in a state of hypnosis, so we don't have to have enough responsibility to really watch our thinking and to be careful about our thinking. I have another clip here that talks about a guy I brought up many times before in terms of religion and its dangers. So give me just a second here, and I'll get a setup for listening to this.
Some people have prospered handsomely. The pastors themselves, they live like rock stars with huge mansions, private jets, and fancy cars.
Oh, yeah.
But when it comes to opulence, few religious leaders compare to Kenneth Copeland.
Amen.
To show you his house, we rented his helicopter so you can see his 18,000 square foot mansion valued at over $6 million.
He lives in this home outside Fort Worth, Texas. It has beautiful water views and comes complete with a boathouse. But that's not all. Copeland is an avid pilot, and here's his pride and joy, a $20 million Cessna Citation jet. It's the fastest private jet money can buy. He said he needed it to better serve the Lord, and proudly did a flyby for his followers after the church bought it.
Shout amen!
But it's not just one plane. We found a fleet of planes registered to the church, and you won't catch him waiting in line at the airport, because he's got his own, the Kenneth Copeland Airport, located right next to his mansion.
I think Copeland is unbelievably greedy.
Amen.
She sent them a lot of money, a whole lot of money.
When Christy Parker's mother died of cancer, she found diaries that showed her mother sent Copeland most of her life savings.
Now, isn't that sad, this woman that sent this TV preacher most of her life savings when she was dying of cancer? And isn't it interesting that here back in the ancient past, Socrates was questioning the religion of Athens, trying to get them to wake up from their delusion while their city was crumbling, while they were in this horrible war with the Peloponnesian war that was destroying them. Eventually, they were even, I think, conquered by Sparta, by their neighbors here. So anyway, we can learn a lot from these great thinkers of the past. Plato, Socrates, makes you wonder, doesn't it? Do we actually learn, or are we repeating the same mistakes? So let's not repeat those same mistakes. Let's pay attention to our thinking. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the show this afternoon. This is Ohio Exopolitics, and we're continuing plodding through that great book, Might of the Thoughts, Machter Gedanken, by Billy Edward Albert Meyer. Have a good day.